Today's episode of Tracking Food is brought to you by Scout Magazine. If you're wanting to learn more about Vancouver's food and cultural sphere with regards to community news, new restaurant openings, central guides to some of the city's best offerings, as well as who's hiring, Scout is where you should go. You can find them on at scoutmagazine.ca. That's scoutmagazine.ca. Welcome to the Track Food Podcast. My name is Jamie Ma, and you're joining me on a very beautiful day today here in early August. I just finished having a great interview with an author named Rachel Neuer. She wrote an excellent new book called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. I was enamored and thrilled that she was willing to jump on the podcast with me. This book was so fun to read. Anybody out there, if you've ever tried MDMA, you know how fun it is, how happy it can make you feel. And it's one of those drugs that's been in the world for a long, long time. This book came on my radar through a couple of newsletters I follow and another podcast that I follow. She had done some interviews for them, riveted and kind of curious about maybe getting it and reading it. And then, when I bought it and picked it up, noticed on the back that two famous authors who kind of write about trauma and who've written about trauma, I should say, in the world, Gabor Mate and then Bessel van der Kolk, wrote great books in the past, one called Body Keeps Score, and obviously Gabor Mate's book, The Myth of Normal, which was huge last year. They gave this book a lot of praise, so it made me even more excited to kind of delve into it, and obviously made me think that there's a lot more nuance and personal anecdote to this drug. And So I read the book, blew through it in a couple of days, and the whole story about how this drug came about in early 1912, by accident, by the company Merck, and then the fact that it was just kind of hidden for a long time, and then just kind of its story going from, you know, a legal compound in the 1970s and then being illegal through government bureaucracy and the war on drugs, and then just kind of its path through the rave scene and then changing name from ecstasy to Molly now, and then just kind of how it's kind of gone through this whole journey. And now it's looked at as a therapeutic substance that's going through trials in the United States. State street trials, I should say, where it's possibly going to be regulated and legalized in assisted therapy is really exciting. So it's come full circle in a lot of ways through just so many different narratives. And there's a lot of people who have been at play through this. And reading the book, you get to meet a lot of these characters, the people that really play pivotal roles. I found it fascinating to read this because I've obviously never thought about Molly and MDMA in the context of anything more than just something that you would take if you're out with friends or you're at a concert or you're dancing or whatever. So to get more of the history and the backstory was really revelatory and fun. And so it was really exciting to sit with Rachel and chat with her. And she really brought a really great, candid voice and had a lot of good information to pass along. And I don't expect all of you to go out there and buy the book, even though I hope you do, because it's a really great read. And I think if you're someone who really loves a good story about stuff like this, but also just there's a lot of personal stuff in here. And, we're living in a world where books like The Body Keeps Score and Gabor Mate's book, The Myth of Normal, are really touching a lot of people because I think we live in a world where there's a lot of people dealing with a lot of problems. And if you're out there and you're struggling, I'm not saying that this book is going to be the be all end all, but it definitely, there's a lot of good nuance in here and there's a lot of good personal narrative and moments that are sad, also moments that are very optimistic. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I was really excited to chat with her and I love doing these little side journey podcasts where I get to really chat with some authors who write some really good stuff. So hope you enjoy them as well. And outside of that, a lot of great stuff up on my website with Scouts, some great new openings. Got this new bar up on Main Street called the Watson, which I'm excited to check out. I haven't been there yet. Sounds promising. And sadly, it sounds like the diamond is done. So unfortunately, that's a sad day for our community here in Vancouver. But we live to see another day and a lot of great memories of the diamond. And well, much love to that team who put it out there for 14 years. But yeah, without further ado, I hope you enjoy this episode with Rachel. Do, as always, check out our presenting sponsor and obviously Scout Magazine, the magazine I work for. Hope you enjoy this episode. Rachel Neuer, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing this morning?
Pretty good. Thank you so much for having me.
This is one of the most exciting and kind of unusual podcasts that I'm very excited to chat with you about today because I never thought I would do a podcast on MDMA.
And I never thought I'd write a book about MDMA, so we've got that in common.
Well, there you go. I read your book all week. I was immersed in it. It is fantastic. It's got a great title because I love Donna Summers. Was that part of where that came about? Like, or just the idea of I Feel Love. For anyone out there who wants to get started with that, your book is called I Feel Love, MDMA, The Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. It came out about 2 months ago. Yeah. Was that title just something that kind of popped into you, or is you just a big fan of the song? Or
it's both, actually. I had the idea for the book while I was actually on MDMA at the height of the pandemic lockdown here in New York City. And that song came on while I was thinking about the idea for this book. And I was like, that's it. That's the title.
But I love about that, because I mean, you actually go in detail in the beginning of your introduction of your book, why you decided to write this book. You give a really good analysis of kind of like what MDMA is a little bit and kind of where it kind of has gone through. And we'll dig into that a little bit here with this interview. But I love your kind of uptake into this idea, because I think you and I come from similar paths. I mean, I didn't first try MDMA until I was about 26 on New Year's Eve. And it was just kind of came to me by happenstance. But I was, as you touch on in your introduction, I didn't drink until I was 24. That was the first time I'd ever done any drug in my life, was when I was 26. So I was like kind of a late bloomer to anything like this. And it sounds like you kind of were as well. And
yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I was a DARE kid, you know, in the US, just say no to drugs, all that stuff. And I just really looked down on people who did drugs. And it just came from a place of lack of understanding, I would say.
Would you say that coming from that place, and then, where, I mean, obviously just think about how you were maybe in your teenage years, and then the fact that now you've written a book like this, is it fascinating to think how much your worldview can change? Because I kind of feel like that's kind of the overall theme of this drug in the world, is where it started and then all the peaks and valleys that it's gone through to where it is now. I think it's kind of very similar in some ways.
Yeah, it's a really great point. Yeah, it has definitely changed and challenged the way I view the world. And I just feel like there is so much complexity and layers of hidden meaning that we don't see behind, you know, everything, whether it is something like MDMA or something like the illegal wildlife trade, which was the subject of my first book. Things aren't always what they seem, or usually aren't what they seem on the surface. There's a lot more going on that we just don't recognize, because it's just easier to take a simplistic view of things and to accept the sort of status quo of what we're taught when we're kids. But this reporting exercise with MDMA has definitely made me more likely to question things and just wonder, okay, what are the forces really at play? You know, what are the complexities we're not seeing?
Mm-hmm. Just to get started in here, what I also loved about this book, right on the cover of your book, Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote the great book, The Body Keeps Score. I'm sure a lot of people out there who are listening right now have probably read it or wanted to read it. He's a big pioneer in the kind of world of trauma. And as well, in the back of the book, Jackie, you have a quote here from Gabor Mate, who anybody here living in the Vancouver area or in Canada, or I guess nationally or globally, knows who he is. He wrote a really pivotal book last year called The Myth of Normal, which also talks about trauma. And they both have, they're a little bit in your book here as well. But what I liked about that, and what I kind of was really excited to learn about, is your book isn't just about the story and kind of how MDMA came about in the world, which it is, but it's also kind of this path where the world is starting to realize, especially with the medical world, is starting to realize that MDMA plays and will and possibly is currently right now playing a role in dealing with people's trauma, understanding PTSD and other things like that. And it could be something in the future that therapists and stuff like that could be using as a tool to help people with a lot of their issues. And I never thought of it in that way. I think for a lot of people, MDMA is kind of something that they use on the weekends or they're out at parties and stuff like this, but that there is therapeutic uses there. And I think for a lot of people, that's very exciting. And for me, it was as I was reading the book.
Yeah, definitely. Before I started this reporting project, I also just associated MDMA with partying. And I'd kind of vaguely heard about the use of MDMA assisted therapy for trauma, but I didn't really know much at all about it. And one of the revelations for me was just learning how prevalent trauma is in society and, you know, just people I know. I would have never assumed or guessed that there is so much suffering out there in the world and just a need for healing and also a lack of really efficacious tools for doing so in a lot of cases.
Well, so why don't we get started with just a simple narration?
Yeah.
What is MDMA and how did it come about? If you can kind of
MDMA is methylene dioxy methamphetamine. It's related to the molecule methamphetamine, actually, but there's an extra N-methyl group on it, which really makes all the difference in terms of the effects it has on the brain and therapeutic uses. A lot of people don't know this. It was first synthesized in 1912 by the German pharmaceutical company Merck. And they weren't actually looking for MDMA. They were looking for a blood clotting agent. And MDMA was just a chemical intermediary on the steps needed to get to that final product. Merck denies that they ever actually discovered MDMA's psychoactive properties. But I don't know. There's some interesting questions around that, whether or not over the decades their scientists did in fact try MDMA or realize its potential. But yeah, MDMA really came back into the spotlight around 1975 when the Bay Area chemist Alexander Shulgin, he's quite famous in psychedelic circles because he synthesized around 200 new psychoactive compounds himself, but he resynthesized MDMA, and in 1976 he tried it himself. And he was so impressed with the effects. He compared it, first of all, to a low-calorie martini, because for people who haven't done MDMA, you actually have more control than you do if you've had several drinks of, you know, alcohol. You are able to talk. You're fully in control of your faculties. You can have a conversation. You can think clearly. You're going to remember everything. You're not going to black out. But what it makes you feel is just really kind of, well, first of all, good. You feel really positive, really physically good, emotionally good. And you just feel really, really connected to yourself, to the other people you're with. If you're at a rave or something like that, you feel connected to everybody on the dance floor. And you're able, at least I am, to let go of your sort of neurotic tendencies and your anxieties and that constant churn that I think so many of us have of, you know, oh, what do I need to do? Like, what about this problem? Like, what about this thing I said to that person? That mental voice, it quiets, and you're able to be fully in the moment in a really beautiful and refreshing way that at least I personally tend to lack in my sober life. So Shulgin noticed this himself from firsthand experience, and a word kept popping into his mind, and that word was window. He felt like MDMA was opening in him a window that he could communicate with his partner, for example, in a way that wasn't clouded with distraction or with fear or stress or anxiety. And he thought to himself that this would be a really fantastic therapeutic tool to aid as a catalyst to just make therapy all the more effective. And that wasn't an original idea, because he was plugging into this framework that I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard of, psychedelic-assisted therapy that was developed in the 1950s around originally LSD. You know, tens of thousands of people in Canada, in the UK, in the US were given LSD in therapeutic context before it was criminalized. So Shulgin thought to himself, MDMA could serve a similar purpose. And he introduced the molecule to a therapist friend of his named Leo Zeff. He was in the Bay Area, and Leo Zeff literally came out of retirement because he was so impressed with the effects of MDMA. And he dedicated much of the rest of his life to spreading MDMA throughout the therapeutic community, to teaching people how to work with it, because he just thought it could be this incredible force for good in terms of trauma, couples therapy, getting to know the self, pretty much any type of psychotherapy MDMA could be an enhancer for, is Leo Zeff's thought. But at the time, therapists knew that if DEA here in the US caught wind of this, they would absolutely schedule MDMA, take it out of bounds for medical use, for research, because this was the height of the war on drugs, and the US government was just really rabidly looking for any drug to schedule it without much consideration for its medical use. And that is actually what happened. MDMA became really, really, really popular with therapists, but they were using it quietly for years, from like 76 to 85, when MDMA was indeed scheduled and criminalized by the DEA.
It was kind of fascinating to read all that stuff in your book and just kind of understanding, because I mean, part of what you were trying to look for in the book, and you mentioned this, is that no one really knows who was the first person to kind of really take it, except there was a couple that you mentioned then in the Bay Area that who took it, and they were kind of thought of as the first two to kind of take it more in kind of the modern context. And that was the stuff that Alexander Shulgin gave them. Is that correct?
Yeah. So everybody, you know, we're humans. We're interested in like the first, the biggest, the best. So there is this ongoing mystery and debate over, you know, who was the first person to ever take MDMA. And there's backing up even more in the 1950s, the US Army was investigating MDMA in its search for chemical truth serum. So there's actually some circumstantial evidence, but no smoking gun at this point, indicating that the US Army might have given mental health patients MDMA covertly without their consent in experiments, basically, to see what it does. So we don't know for sure that MDMA actually ever got into a person from the Army's experiments, but we do know that they tested MDMA in monkeys, dogs, and rodents in the 1950s. So definitely the first person who took MDMA might have been someone who did it without consent. So I think that's important to point out, especially since we're now looking at giving MDMA-assisted therapy to veterans, for example. But again, we don't know for sure if that happened. We do know too that in 1971, there was some seizures of MDMA from some labs in the US. So people think that chemists pivoted from making MDA, which is a related compound, to making MDMA to get around the fact that MDA had just been scheduled and made illegal. So if they just stuck this little methyl group onto MDA, that way they could get around the law because they had a new molecule. But again, we don't know who those chemists were or who their customers were. We don't have any names for who might have been the first person in the early 70s. The names we do have, as you mentioned, are a couple named Carl Reznikoff and Judith Gipps. They were undergraduate students at the University of California, Berkeley. And Carl was a drug aficionado. He had been really interested in psychedelics since he was in junior high school. And he had taken Alexander Shulgin, the chemist we were just talking about, on as a mentor. And Shulgin was working with Carl on a summer project and said, you know, we should come up with something to synthesize, something to do. And it was actually Carl's idea to make MDMA because he had experience with MDA and thought, okay, you know what? Methamphetamine is more euphoric than plain old amphetamine. And the only difference there is this N-methyl group. So Carl's idea was to add this N-methyl group to MDA and see if it would make the experience even more pleasant in the same way it does methamphetamine over amphetamine. So they did that. They synthesized the drug in the basement at UC Berkeley on like a summer afternoon in 1975. Shulgin wound up taking most of the synthesis, the product, home, but he gave Carl some doses. And then Carl and Judith wound up taking it on a ferry from San Francisco to Sausalito one September afternoon. And they just had a really great time. Carl told me that MDMA definitely had psychedelic properties, but it was interesting to him because he'd never had any moments of anxiety or fear or like, oh gosh, you know, where is this going, that he would on a normal traditional psychedelic like LSD, for example. So it was just a really pleasant, beautiful afternoon. And they were just struck by just how gorgeous the world is, how easily they could talk to each other because they were dating at the time, and just how open they felt.
I'm not going to lie. I mean, like, I've done my fair share of MDMA in my life. And so when I was reading, I was laughing because I can just remember so many times in my life being at the music festivals or out with friends where like you're on Molly and just all you think about is how you are and how excited you're about life. And you're like, this is the greatest feeling ever. And
it is such a beautiful feeling. It's hard to describe in words for people who haven't tried it.
Yeah. Like, I have pretty good memories of, I remember in 2014, I was at a music festival in Austin, Texas, and I was seeing the band, The War on Drugs, and I was just coming up on my Molly. And I was just like, this is like, I think I sent a text to my brother and I was like, I don't think I've ever felt this happy in my entire life. And there's something about the drug. That's what it does. I mean, it's still, if I take any drug out there, it's definitely my favorite for sure. It's something that I really love. I love the way it makes you feel happy and makes you want to dance. And it's interesting when you talk about a lot of the stuff that happened in the 1950s, because when I think about all that, it just makes me think of the movie, The Manchurian Candidate with Denzel Washington and how crazy that was. But also, it touches on what you were saying is when he talked about, Alexander Shulgin talked about the idea of that window, because that's exactly what happened with LSD and Albert Hoffman and all that stuff and kind of how it got to the 1940s. It's kind of funny because I think I mentioned this in my email when I sent it to you, but how pivotal my home province of Saskatchewan played with LSD.
Yeah, for sure.
The early days. And you even mentioned it a few times here in your book as well at the University of Saskatchewan, my alma mater and stuff like that. So I always find that fascinating that my little province had a little play in some of these discoveries. So we're looking at 1970s now. Alexander Shulgin's kind of brought it into kind of the medical community a little bit. Can you talk about like what is MDMA's effect on humans? Like, why does it make people happy and kind of how it works within the brain and stuff like that and how it kind of lets people let go? Because it talks about here, I think I read it somewhere, it deals with the love. It kind of helps, it basically unleashes a large amount of serotonin and then one called oxytocin, which a lot of people dub as the love hormone. Can you talk about how that works in the brain and what it actually does?
Yeah, for sure. So MDMA's structure does mimic serotonin. And for listeners who don't know, serotonin is a neurotransmitter, which is just a chemical messenger in the brain. And serotonin is kind of a jack of all trades neurotransmitter. It plays all kinds of roles for us, from regulating sleep and mood to hunger and stuff with our blood circulation. So it plays all sorts of things. But so MDMA plugs into serotonin transporters in the brain. And these are just parts of neurons that move serotonin in and out of synapses. And SSRI drugs work the same way. They also plug into these transporters. And what SSRIs do is they prevent serotonin from being taken back up by neurons so quickly. So SSRIs are causing serotonin to hang out in your synapses longer, so you get more of effects from serotonin. MDMA actually takes that process a step further. Rather than just blocking the uptake of serotonin, it actively causes your nerves to dump their serotonin out. So it's like a reverse vacuum. It's like pumping all your serotonin out into these synapses. So suddenly you're just completely flooded with serotonin. Something like 80% of the brain's serotonin is released during an MDMA trip. That also triggers the release of oxytocin. There is some neuroscience showing that serotonin plus oxytocin in the brain basically equals that love feeling. There's a flurry of other neurotransmitters are involved as well, but it's really serotonin is the prime one, followed by oxytocin. So in terms of the brain regions, one of MDMA's most profound effects is it turns down activity in the amygdala, which is the brain's fear center. So that's why, you know, suddenly in a therapeutic context, for example, you're able to engage with perhaps memories that you normally would find so unpleasant or scary that you just repress them, that you don't want to talk about them. But under the influence of MDMA, you no longer have that fear blocking you, and you can really engage with those things in an honest and open-eyed way that you couldn't normally. It also, because it inspires feelings of connection and lowers stress and fear, it helps to enhance the therapist-patient bond. So you'll find yourself trusting your therapist more, which is going to make, as long as you have a good therapist, the therapy all the more effective. And that also happens in a recreational context too. So there's a lot of people who just without any guidance have used MDMA on their own to get over social anxiety and just practice being more extroverted. I've talked to autistic adults who've done that and also neurotypical friends. One of my friends, for example, was really shy growing up, and he took MDMA and he just kind of witnessed himself being super social at a club and seeing people reacting to him in a really positive way. And that made him think, I could do this in my sober life. So he would occasionally practice on MDMA, just being social, and then apply those lessons to his life otherwise. And it's really changed him. He's a really social guy now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I will 100% agree when you talk about that, because I mean, I was extremely shy growing up. I was someone who was very nervous of being around other individuals, and I can definitely understand. I mean, a lot of this also just comes with maturity, as becoming more of an adult and feeling more comfortable in one's skin. But I can definitely hone in on kind of that feeling that what MDMA gives. It definitely, it makes you feel less in your own thoughts, in your own brain. It definitely makes you feel more open to human connection. And I think there's something powerful about that, that I think it overwhelms you, especially when you first really take it for the first time. It really kind of washes over you. It's kind of like this really cool feeling. And I'm sure a lot of listeners out there have actually felt that probably in a lot of ways.
Being in tune with whoever you're talking to if you choose to have a conversation on it.
Absolutely. It's interesting how that does that all in the brain. And then you're kind of, we're at this point in history, you know, in the mid 70s, early 80s, where it looks like MDMA does have a pathway towards helping individuals with a lot of issues and stuff like this. But then it kind of runs into obviously what Alexander Shulgin, what you mentioned earlier about that window closing. And there is a gentleman who kind of plays a pivotal role. There's two people who play pivotal roles at this point, Michael Clegg and then Rick Doblin. And Rick Doblin [S2] Yes. [S1] Is huge in this book. I mean, his role basically from this point on is, I think people probably really should know who he is and how important he's played in kind of the growth of MDMA in our culture. But also Michael Clegg is kind of like the mercenary who's looking at it in a different way. It's fascinating to think that it's Dallas, Texas is kind of the area where MDMA kind of finds its prominence in our global world. Can you talk about both these gentlemen and how they figure around in this early 80s vortex, I guess?
It is interesting to make the comparison between Michael Clegg and Rick Doblin, because they're both people who really believe in MDMA and believe in its power and want to make it legal and spread it around the world and get it into the hands of as many people as possible, you know, who want to try it. But, you know, they're coming at that goal from very different directions. So Michael Clegg was one of, if not the biggest MDMA dealers in the early 80s up until the early 90s, when he and his associates were arrested by the US federal government. So Clegg, he was a Catholic priest dropout, if that makes sense. He was someone who was always searching his entire life for meaning, who felt like, you know, he was put on this earth to serve a bigger purpose and to enlighten humanity and bring peace to the world and things like that. He went and he tried yoga in Costa Rica. So he got really into yoga. And it was sometime around that journey that he was introduced to MDMA. He always says it's earlier than other people say it was. But that's another thing about Michael Clegg. The words people used to describe him to me were, you know, things like liar, like phony. I mean, his former associates, I'll tell you, did not have a lot of good things to say about him.
It was pretty funny to read the book. You kind of like put like little notes. You're like, all right, this is not what most people say about him. And like,
yeah, I just, unfortunately, Michael Clegg would not talk to me for the book, but I was able to run some fact checking by him. And like literally every fact checking point, he was like, no, lies, lies. And I asked him about this guy that he used to work with. And he was like, I don't even know who this person is. And this is a person that he literally turned into the US government and got convicted for MDMA trafficking. Like he ruined this person's life. So anyway, everything that comes out of Michael Clegg's mouth, you have to take with a grain of salt, if not a shaker of salt, as one source told me. So anyway, Michael Clegg became this major MDMA dealer. The thing is, he had no background in chemistry. So he recruited this really, really fascinating chemist. Her name is Karina. I was able to interview her. She's a hiking guide in Sedona now. And she actually took me on a hike during our interview. It was really an interesting way to learn about her life. But she migrated or immigrated to the US from the Philippines and became a chemist at Intel. And she was kind of working at Intel in the early 80s, you know, a woman in a really male-dominated office. She's getting frustrated because she wasn't really being intellectually challenged, but she was having to work all hours of the day and night. And one of her bosses came to her and offered for her to make some extra money on the side if she joined this kind of covert project. And it turned out that the project was synthesizing MDMA and helping to take it from small scale to wholesale levels. And Michael Clegg was involved in that. He was heading it. And Karina wound up coming on full time with them. And at first she was seeing this just as a money-making project, but then she actually tried MDMA for herself. And it was this revelation, you know, she also just kind of got on the MDMA ship, I guess, and thought, you know, this is a way that I can change the world. The molecule is speaking to me. Like my job is to get this out to as many people as possible. So she and Michael Clegg and all of their associates were pretty idealistic in that sense. And I did talk to the federal prosecutor who worked on their case. And he said it was so fascinating for him because he'd worked on tons of drug trafficking cases, you know, with cocaine and meth and everything else. But this was the first time that he had dealt with highly intelligent, educated individuals who had this really altruistic, aspirational slant to everything they did. And it was, yes, about making millions of dollars, but it was also, they had these more lofty goals and visions for themselves. So that was Michael Clegg on one side. Switching to Rick Doblin. Rick was a kid who was brought up with dinner table conversations about the Holocaust. And he was always afraid, he said in his youth, that at any moment, at any time, all the people around him could suddenly just break out into genocidal mania and, you know, start killing each other. And this was this pervasive fear he lived with. And as a result, he too was always sort of searching for a way to find a solution to that, to prevent another genocide from ever occurring and to just show people how much we actually all have in common and bring us together. And he kind of grappled around for that answer. You know, he tried a lot of LSD and other drugs. He tried all kinds of therapy and it wasn't really working. And finally, in MDMA, he seemed to have found a solution. He tried it himself and just couldn't believe, you know, how easy it was to, with a girlfriend at the time, to talk to his girlfriend about some difficult issues they'd been having and to resolve those issues. And then once forgiveness was given during that conversation, it was given. It wasn't like when they came off the drug, they still were harboring any ill will toward each other. So he realized it was this really powerful tool for bringing people together, for enhancing communication and just togetherness. But then the DEA moved to schedule MDMA, and that really was partly because of Michael Clegg. Michael Clegg was pumping MDMA out into the recreational community, especially Dallas. The group of MDMA traffickers that he worked with, they called themselves the Texas Group because they were headquartered in Dallas. And there was a club at the time called the Start Club, which honestly, if I could travel back in time, I would just go to the Start Club. It looks like an amazing place.
Pretty fun. I was like, what is this place? It sounded like...
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it looked incredible. I watched an unpublished documentary about it, which I really hope is released soon because it's a fantastic documentary. And just like the hedonism, anything goes. And also just everyone was welcome at the Start Club in a way that hadn't been possible before in Texas or really in the South. Didn't matter, you know, your gender, your race, your background, whatever, anyone was welcome there. And MDMA was, you know, the substance that really greased the wheels of that possibility because it was legal at the time. And they just started giving it out and selling it at the Start Club. Bartenders would give you an MDMA pill with your beer, or the Coke check person would, you know, slip it into your cigarette pack. So, you know, everybody at the Start Club was loved up on MDMA on the dance floor, and it was just a really beautiful moment in time. So yeah, Michael Clegg was really overtly pushing MDMA out in Texas, also in places like New York and the Bay Area and Los Angeles. And sure enough, you know, it caught the DEA's attention because it was just becoming so obvious. And Rick Doblin even tried to kind of run interference on Clegg. He and an associate of his, Debbie Harlow, went and visited Michael Clegg at his like big mansion in Northern California and tried to talk Clegg out of not selling MDMA, but just kind of like doing it more covertly and with some discretion. And Michael Clegg just wasn't hearing it. He spent like 5 hours lecturing them about, you know, his purpose in the world and changing minds and consciousness. And then finally at like 3 a.m, after talking to Michael Clegg for, you know, literally hours, everyone was exhausted. And Michael Clegg looked at them and just said, you know what, frankly, if it becomes illegal, I'll just make more money. So that was sort of the bottom line. And that is what happened. The DEA moved to schedule MDMA. But there is one important point that I think a lot of people will be surprised to hear, which is that a group of therapists and doctors actually challenged the DEA on that decision. And Rick Doblin was heading that case as sort of the organizer, along with Debbie Harlow and another friend of theirs. And this is a team of therapists like Alexander Shulgin, Leo Zeff, and also, you know, Harvard professors, like really, really respected people in the medical and therapeutic community. And they put together this case to the DEA to argue that MDMA should actually be a Schedule III drug. You know, it would have controlled MDMA, but it would have allowed them to continue using it medically and also to conduct research on it. And they presented this in court, and the judge actually sided with them. They won the case. The judge said, you know, it should be Schedule III. You know, you've proven that it is to have medical utility. It shouldn't be Schedule I. But because this was an administrative law court, the DEA didn't actually have to take that ruling as a ruling or as a judgment. They could just do what they want. It was a suggestion. So in the end, they did exactly what they wanted to all along and put it on Schedule I. And that's where it's been ever since.
That was kind of like one of those moments where I was reading in the book. I was like, oh my God, that must have been so frustrating for them to have that decision happen. And then obviously the DEA just looking at you and just like, nah, we're not going to listen to you. So who cares? And I think for people out there listening, I mean, the DEA and how things shaped out in the United States, I mean, it played a role here up in Canada and it played a role out in the UK and stuff like that. Like they kind of follow each other's lead. And those moments right there with it kind of telling, I mean, that's a time where the war on drugs was a big thing in America and they were really trying to push that. And there was Just Say No campaigns and, you know, just staying away from all that stuff. And so I think there was a lot of probably smear campaigning and just misinformation. And it's unfortunate to read that in the book and know that we'd probably be a lot further along when it comes to trauma and dealing with MDMA.
Oh, yeah.
People understanding where it is. And, you know, I mean, like up here in Canada, I mean, it's kind of a very similar thing. I mean, like marijuana was legalized a couple of years ago. And you touch on this near the end of the book about how, like, by legalizing a substance, you can give people more clarity on the dosage they're taking, how pure it is, and then also people can have better awareness of what they're able to take. Because, you know, you talk about this near the end of the book, this young girl takes some MDMA and she takes a massive amount, not realizing how much she's taking, and then she dies. Her mother initially is kind of like really anti-drugs, but then she comes around to the idea that being anti is not going to get rid of everything. It's just going to put it into a underground where a lot of drugs are right now. And I'm not advocating that, you know, people out there should stuff like that. I'm just saying that by having things legalized, you can have more awareness and control and understanding and stuff like that. So it's unfortunate that they hit that moment in the early 80s and then it just kind of, it was idle basically for what, 30 years?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's been basically 38 years. So almost 40 years since it was made illegal. And I know that because my birthday is right around when MDMA was scheduled. So it's very easy for me to keep track of how many years it's been.
The other part that I thought was fascinating is like when I was reading about that Karina Alvarez Leverie fans. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. It was because I was like, oh, so she's basically Heisenberg from Breaking Bad.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, at the end, she's like, yeah, I was just like that guy in Breaking Bad, except I didn't go into trailer parks. I was like, nice.
Yeah, that's pretty
But it's, yeah, she's such a character.
Well, that's how this happens, right? And it's like, it's understandable to see a person like Michael Clay come around and probably did have some visions of grandeur in the sense of like, I want to get this to the whole world because it makes me feel so good and it's such a great product. But his was more driven by the financial implications. And then Rick Doblin, I mean, they lose that case, but he never let go. He basically just, he created this nonprofit and he's basically just been pushing for it. He's kind of, you would say in a lot of ways, he's probably one of the main reasons why it is where it is now today as something.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I can say with almost absolute certainty that we would not be where we are today if it weren't for Rick's efforts. Yeah, that's a great point actually for listeners. Well, they won the case, but they lost the case in terms of the actual outcome with the DEA in 86. MDMA was scheduled and pretty much everyone gave up on it. You know, most therapists stopped working with it because they could lose their license or even their freedom. All the advocates kind of just were like, well, there's that. We gave it our best shot, but there's nothing we can do. It's just going to be taken away from us forever. But everybody that I interviewed told me there was just one person who didn't accept no for an answer. And that person was Rick Doblin. He just has that personality, like very tenacious, very stubborn, and just like an eternal optimist too. Yeah, I don't know how he's maintained the level of energy and commitment that he has, but he has. And as a result, we've finally gotten where we are today. And, you know, just literally decades that he's been chipping away at this and pushing. And he's built this nonprofit group you mentioned. It's the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, as it's known. MAPS has grown to a couple hundred at least employees. And it was founded as a nonprofit. It's still a nonprofit, but they also have a for-profit arm that's fully owned by the nonprofit now. The for-profit group will be synthesizing MDMA once it's approved by the FDA. But MAPS has been a sponsor of all the clinical trials for MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, and has just really paved the way for MDMA to be studied by other groups too, because there was just so much bureaucracy and red tape and obstacles put in the way of actually just getting MDMA into clinical trials because it was a scheduled drug.
I mean, for listeners out there, this is where I think part of the book really kind of takes a big change, because your book up to this point is really kind of like, here's what it was, here's how MDMA kind of came into our world, here's kind of like a lot of the pitfalls that it kind of hit and the roadblocks. But then what happens is after this happens, Rick Doblin kind of keeps pushing through. And then you go into this kind of part where it's really kind of personal, where you introduce some stories, a young woman named Lori and her mother Trish, who really dies because of PTSD and stuff like this. You start talking about how PTSD and you talk about another, there's a suicide by this gentleman named Zulfi Riza, who calls Rick Doblin one day saying that he's dealing with a lot of problems and he's kind of come across, he's looking for answers. And he unfortunately does kill himself. And he basically just says, hey, find a way to get this out there because I've reached my limit. And then you talk about this gentleman named John, who was in the army, and he dealt with a lot of problems. And this is where I find where your story really kind of hits a personal note, because this is, I think, where a lot of the great progress comes from, is based on the idea of helping people through their issues and then how MDMA really opens up a window in people's minds and really helps them. Like, it's not as you say, it's not a panacea. It's not something that like you take it and you're cured, but it does help people have a little bit more clarity and mind-opening feelings. And you talk about what it was like kind of getting into those more personal stories throughout the book and kind of seeing how over the last 40 years it's progressed. And Rick Doblin's, I think what his role after that was, basically said, if we're going to get this passed, we have to find a way to get it FDA approved.
Yeah. So Rick knew basically that the only way to bring MDMA back into sort of the light of scientific and medical respectability was to go through official channels. So through the government pharmaceutical approval system overseen by the FDA and do really rigorous clinical trials showing what MDMA can and can't be used for, and that it's safe, that it's efficacious, all those things that you'd have to do for any pharmaceutical. So that's what he's been sort of chugging away at for 38 years now. But at first, he actually wanted to use MDMA-assisted therapy to treat existential anxiety in terminal cancer patients. So he spent basically all of the 1990s working on that. And for various reasons I detail in the book, those trials sort of fell apart, not because it doesn't work for that, but just bureaucracy, relationships with people. So in the early aughts, Rick turned his attention away from existential anxiety and death to PTSD. And that was actually a strategic move on his part, because he realized, okay, we're all going to die, but people don't want to think about that. It's a really unpleasant thing to contemplate. And one thing that we can get a, all kind of rally around, though, is especially in this country, in the U.S., is veterans. Support of our veterans is a bipartisan issue. So he realized that if MDMA-assisted therapy could be applied to treat PTSD in veterans, this is a way that he could get support across the political sphere and really just make this idea a lot more palatable for people. And that is exactly how things have played out. And he also, he had this idea before 9/11 happened, which is really, I think, notable as well. So the veteran issue has gotten all the worse since then, just with the veteran suicides and things like that. And veterans have really rallied around MDMA-assisted therapy and other psychedelic-assisted therapy themselves as well. And that's really helped to push these through. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's those personal stories that really, I think, bring people into this, hearing how someone was suffering and how MDMA-assisted therapy helped to turn their life around and even save their life. We're human beings. We connect with the stories of other human beings. So that's been a really, really powerful tool. That said, veterans actually, they get the most press for PTSD, but trauma affects all kinds of people, and especially children who were neglected or abused, and also women who are the survivors of abuse. So, you know, I did interview one veteran for the book, but I also interviewed a number of other people who shared their stories.
I've talked about this in the past. You know, I grew up in a pretty troubled home, not a lot of fun things that happened to me as well. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening out there, that's probably happened to them. And I think that's probably where the part of the book where I really kind of resonated in a lot of ways. And I think if anybody out there can pick this up, there's a lot of emotional part that comes in there, because it, I think this is where really the kind of the crux of what MDMA, I think for a lot of people out there thinking it's, I go out there and I party with my friends. But like for a lot of people dealing with therapy, dealing with their personal trauma and dealing with their issues, for scientists, this is where it's really been pivotal for them, and how it makes people feel vulnerable. It opens them up. It works inside, and it really helps them deal with a lot of the issues that they've had to deal with and kind of come to grips with them. And I think that's part of where I thought the book was really fascinating, is it really brought that into light. And just, I had no idea. Like, I think you touch on this in the book that, like, you say after 9/11, there's been over 30,000 veterans who've committed suicide. Like, I think that's, am I correct in that number?
I'm one of these people who can't remember numbers off the top of their head, but that sounds about right. I know that there's been more veteran suicides since 9/11 than there has been service members lost in the war. So that's really, really telling. And it just shows the massive burden of this problem. And we send our service members overseas and nobody tells them, you know, you're going to come back a completely different person and basically have your life taken away in a lot of cases for those people who really develop crippling cases of PTSD.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for you as someone who's writing about this book and you're meeting all these people and you're doing all these interviews, like, was this an awakening for you to understand all this stuff?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, like a lot of my past reporting has dealt with really terrible issues of wildlife trafficking and poaching. So it's not like I've just had some rosy career, but hearing people's stories firsthand, yeah, it was really, really powerful. And more often than not, like by the end of the interview, my source would be in tears, I would be in tears. But one thing that I really appreciated from this book project and was one of the reasons I was attracted to MDMA as a subject is because there is a lot of optimism for the future. You know, a lot of the people I talk to, they're not quote unquote cured. And they would even say, you know, I don't even know what that means to be cured, but they're able to really function and thrive in their life in a way that they weren't before they undertook this therapy. So I think it's really important to acknowledge the burden of trauma in society, but also that for a lot of people, there could be hope with this treatment or with similar psychedelic assisted treatments.
Mm-hmm. So I thought about this earlier when I was going to do about this interview. Anybody out there listening right now, I'm sure you know, maybe you're getting curious about this, or you're like, I've done Molly in the past. Can we maybe talk to people about the idea of, like, we're not expecting you to just go out and do a pill. And you're going to be able
to. Yeah, that's a great point.
But like, I guess from what you've gathered and what you've learned, what's the best way for people to look at this and assess if they want to use MDMA in a, or sort of assisted therapy area? I mean, it's not legal yet, but can you talk about where it is right now and that process? And
so for the US FDA to approve MDMA assisted therapy, they require 2 phase 3 clinical trials. So these are like late stage clinical trials just to prove overall efficacy and safety on the product. So one of those clinical trials was published in 2021. The other one is currently undergoing peer review, and I've heard that the results are just as promising. The first one is around 100 participants, and 2/3 of them emerged after 3 sessions of MDMA-assisted therapy, no longer meeting a diagnosis for PTSD. And these are people with severe cases of PTSD. You know, They've had it for more than 10 years. They've tried all kinds of other therapies and pharmaceuticals. A lot of them have also contemplated suicide, like very difficult cases to treat. So those are really promising results. I've heard that the results from the second phase 3 trial are just as promising. So once those results are published in the scientific literature, MAPS is going to submit an application for a new drug to the FDA. The FDA will then have like a certain amount of time within which they'll have to respond. But it's looking like by this time next year, MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD could be, or probably, hopefully, will be approved in the US. Once that happens, doctors can actually use MDMA as an off-label prescription. This is, any pharmaceutical can be used off-label. And that just means that doctors can use their best judgment to prescribe something that isn't approved for. So for example, a doctor, once MDMA is approved for PTSD, could use it to treat social anxiety in their patient, things like that. However, you raise this point, and it's such a very important one. We're only talking about MDMA in the context of MDMA-assisted therapy. Nobody's going to be written a prescription that they're going to go fill at their pharmacy for MDMA and come home and like take it as they would, you know, a traditional pharmaceutical like an SSRI. Absolutely not. MDMA will only be taken with a therapist. And the way that works is usually you start with a few sober sessions of therapy to kind of get to know your doctor or your therapist to sort out what it is you want to deal with. And then on the day of the active therapy session, you come in, you take the MDMA, you are given like an eye mask and headphones. There's a couch or a bed that you can recline on. And once the drug starts hitting, everybody has a different experience. Some people get really chatty and want to talk through their trauma with their therapist. Some people get very, very internal and hardly say a word. Some people engage directly with their traumatic memories. Some people take a roundabout way and, you know, assess like memories throughout their whole life. Some people, things get very abstract. You know, everyone is different. And it's also important to point out that this isn't going to work for everybody. There's no medication that's going to work for 100% of the population. Most participants in the phase 3 trial showed progress, but not all of them did. So unfortunately, you know, it's not going to be a magic bullet for everybody. And another important point is that for MDMA-assisted therapy to really work, people have to integrate the lessons that they learned while on it. So one way that MDMA-assisted therapy often fails to deliver results is a person has some great revelations while they're undergoing the treatment, but then they return to their life and they return to whatever situation that was causing their trauma to begin with, you know, whether that's an abusive relationship or poverty or whatever else. So you need to be able to integrate what you learn to your life, but there's also things that MDMA just can't solve, societal level problems that's beyond the ability of MDMA-assisted therapy to fix. So until we fix our society, we're not going to magically be rid of trauma.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, I interviewed a gentleman named Spencer Hoxwell, who started a nonprofit here in Canada called Theracil. And Theracil's gained a lot of traction in the psilocybin world. And they're trying to work on getting it. It's kind of, I feel like it's in a similar phase right now in Canada here with a lot of the helping people deal with, I think it's like end of life treatment and assisted dying and helping them deal with kind of a lot of the processes and the trauma that they're dealing with their lives. And there's a lot of good literature that's coming out and results through what they've been trying to promote. And through psilocybin. And psilocybin definitely has a lot of similar kind of paradigms here with MDMA. And I feel like once it passes in the United States, I can definitely see it passing up here in Canada. And I'm pretty confident with that. I think it's good to see and understand because a lot of, for both with psilocybin here in Canada and obviously with MDMA, both of them are done in under the same type of idea. You're with a doctor, you do it in kind of a controlled setting. And a lot of people have said that, you know, these trials, these things that I've done have really made significant improvements in their lives, and they've really helped them deal with a lot of their personal issues. And not to say that anybody out there like myself or anybody who wants to go there and do MDMA, you can't still feel good and experience good euphoria from taking it. But there is ways where these drugs hopefully in the future will have good benefits in a medical standpoint, helping people deal with really deep-seated issues. And that's, I think, probably what's so promising about what your book talks about is this drug came about and it's kind of gone through a whole litany of weird phases. It was kind of a big raver drug and stuff like that, and how it's come full circle in a lot of ways and still very prominent in our world in those ways, but it definitely has a place in our scientific world, which is kind of very exciting, I guess.
And yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I sure hope so.
Well, and the other part is just the fact that, like, you talk about this in the book where when therapists are talking about, like, they've kind of reached their limits in a lot of ways of finding treatments for helping people. And looking at psychoactive drugs is definitely a market where they haven't been able to look at for 4 years. And there's a lot of promising results coming from that. And so I think people are a lot more in our society now in 2023. I think we're a lot more open to stuff like that. I wouldn't be surprised if marijuana was legal federally in the United States in 5 years. I mean, I could see that happening.
Yeah, geez, it's about time. Yeah, for sure.
I can tell you for sure, here up in Canada, I have Americans who come up sometimes when I see them in the open. You can just buy marijuana everywhere. I'm like, yeah, it's not even, like, no one cares.
Yeah, it's like alcohol, just regulate it.
Exactly. So overall, I guess just to close up here with you, I mean, what's your overall feeling? What's been the reception for you with this book since it's come out? What have people been saying to you, and how has it been for you to have this in the world?
Yeah, I mean, quite positive. Personally, I'm just really happy it is out there, and I hope that it finds its way to people who will find it useful, whether that's because, like, they themselves are considering MDMA-assisted therapy, if they have a loved one who's considering it, or if they just want to know more about the history and journey and science of this molecule. Just anybody looking for a good read, I think, will appreciate this book. MDMA is sort of a lens through which we can view all sorts of facets of society, from culture to criminal justice to psychology, just to what makes us tick. So I'm really happy it's out there, and I hope people find value in it.
Yeah, I mean, reading it looked like it was a lot of work. So
it was.
I'm sure it was. Sure.
Yeah.
For all listeners out there, I mean, as I touched on at the beginning of the episode, I mean, if you're someone who is kind of like myself, curious about stuff like this, you know, if you've loved Gabor Mate's work, if you've read Bessel van der Kolk stuff, one of my last episodes, I talked with a professor here who wrote a really good book on how alcohol kind of was a big purveyor in developing our society when it comes to kind of our hedonistic ways and helped bond human beings together. So, like, this book, I Feel Love by Rachel, is fantastic. It really gives you a good narrative of what MDMA is. And also there's a lot of literature about the personal role and growth and within this community. And, you know, if you want to understand what it is, and that it shouldn't be such a stigmatized thing. Also, I forgot to touch on this. Can you explain why it's no longer called ecstasy?
So. Oh, yeah. Well, some people call it ecstasy. In Europe, for example, they haven't adopted Molly. So, yeah, one of Michael Clegg's associates named it ecstasy as sort of a marketing thing in the early 1980s. He thought ecstasy will be a really good name that'll help this drug sell. He was right. But then, because MDMA was so persecuted in the 1990s, and it, you know, was attached to, like, eating holes in ravers' brains and all these kind of hysterical, erroneous public health messaging about it, and also laws that came about in the UK and the US criminalizing not just MDMA, but anyone perceived as throwing an event at which ecstasy was known to be used. Club promoters and event promoters basically wanted to get away from this, like, tainted word of ecstasy. So they rebranded MDMA as Molly, which is like this cutesy shorthand for molecule. And it was also supposed to imply that what you're getting as Molly is, you know, the pure molecule, which isn't true at all. You know, it could be pure, but it could also be tainted with other more harmful or just inert substances. Molly and ecstasy are both just nicknames for what's supposed to be MDMA.
I know, when I was talking to some friends yesterday at work, there, I was telling them about this interview, and they were like, yeah, but they're like, ecstasy is different from Molly. And I was like, no, it's not.
Yeah, it's so funny, like, the number of people who think that, but it just shows that the marketing worked. You know, people think it's somehow different, and it's not.
Not at all. Well, Rachel, I thank you so much for taking time today. I appreciate all your hard work here. I wish you all the best with this and moving forward with this book. And got any new book ideas on the horizon?
I have to see how this one does. I feel like this is just a very expensive hobby of mine for the moment. And, like, I need to actually be able to pay my bills at some point. So we'll see. If this one does okay, I would love to write another book. But if not, I should probably just get back to normal journalism.
I hope you sell millions of copies of this book and, you know, traveling the world, and we'll get more books from you. So everybody out there, do pick up a book of I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. No problem.